Hey, wonderfuls. Welcome to episode 500 of the JV Club. Oh my goodness. Well, we made it to 500. If the sound is a little bit different in this episode, it's because I'm recording from up in San Francisco during SF Sketchfest. So that is what's going on there. But I am so excited to be ringing in my 500th episode. Of course, I want to thank my beloved Chris Royce for being involved in the JV Club and JV Club social media and just being a general cheerleader for so many years. All of you, so many of you have been listening to the podcast since the beginning, and I just want you to know that you're on my mind here as I record my 500th intro. And of course, Julian and everybody at Max Fun for creating such a wonderful environment to be a podcaster. So thanks, everybody. This episode, I'm really excited about it. I had a conversation on the Journos podcast with my sweetie Brandon and his podcasting partner, Steven, and that led to this episode on my podcast. So I would definitely recommend that you listen to our conversation first. But if you can't do that for some reason, go back to it. It was a really, really fun conversation, and you will find out more about how we sort of entered into this idea and this concept that we talk about in this 500th episode. So it was a totally different thing I've never done before, and it seemed like a really cool way to kind of mark the 500th. The other thing that you will hear throughout the episode is Julian has very sweetly and wonderfully agreed to drop in at various spots some little messages from a few of my friends from high school, many of whom you've heard either on the podcast or heard about, and then also a little something from someone else who knew me when I was a teenager. So enjoy those as well. I hope you will. It meant the world to me that people took time out to put that together for me. So I love you, my dear and wonderful friends and family, and please enjoy the episode. I think you will. Hey, wonderfuls! This is a very unusual JV Club, but it's a very unusual JV Club for a couple of reasons. One is that this is my 500th episode, and because it's my 500th episode, I wanted to do something a little unique, and I had kind of a perfect opportunity lay bare in front of me. You all know about my sweetie Brandon. I've talked about him many times. I've also talked about his podcast Journos that he does with his partner in crime, Steven Jackson. And if you are a listener of We Got This with Mark and Hal, you already know who they are, and you may already have an inkling as to what we are doing today. But I'm going to fill you in for anybody who doesn't know. So Journos is an amazing podcast. I love it so much. Brandon and Steven are both journalists, and their approach to talking about the news, but also talking about the news and just about everything in between. Someone once described their podcast as feeling like you were hanging out with very cool, very smart people at a party who actually like wanted to include you in the conversation. That's what their podcast is to me. And they find these amazing ways of stringing together different ideas that you would never think had anything to do with one another. And then you realize like, oh, wow, this is a really interesting lens through which to look at this other thing. So all this being said, they have also recently started sort of, well, why don't you guys put it into your words, since it's your service, quote unquote, that you're offering to other podcasts and other folks.
Sure. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Brandon. Hi, Steven.
Hi, Janet.
We just woke up, and we just woke up on the floor of this podcasting room, and I don't know what we're doing. We are Journos, and
hello.
We have started a service, or an initiative. Well, we'll call it a service. It's called Journos as a Service, and we essentially do for news and information what private detectives used to do for cheating husbands. We go in search of...
I bet they still do that.
Yeah, we could do that too. We go in search of answers to questions that you might have, mysteries, big and small. So we'll be showing up on podcasts. And Janet came to us on our show with a big question. Yep.
It's true. Well, I listened to your episode with Mark and Hal, and I just loved it so much. But I should say I listened to your episodes with Mark and Hal because you started out by having Mark and Hal on your podcast, and they asked their question on your podcast, and then you came on their podcast to answer it and to illuminate them. And so we've done the same thing. About a week ago, we got together and met and talked about a little bit about my podcast. I thought it was, from my perspective, a really fun conversation. I find myself to be very fascinating and interesting. So, of course, on that end, I was pleased, but I was also very pleased by talking to you guys. And I feel really excited to hear what you're going to tell me about what I asked. And I'm tempted to not say too much more than that because I want people to go and listen to the episode of Journos, where we sort of is the first half of this conversation. That doesn't mean that you won't be like that you should just stop what you're doing right now, although feel free to stop what you're doing right now. Go listen to it if you would like to. That you won't be able to follow along, but I feel like that's it's a key component of kind of what we're doing here today.
Yeah, I think that's fair. We wanted to answer a question about the sort of recurring theme that goes throughout all of the episodes of the JV Club, which is what do all these people have in common and what do you talk about a lot? And something about the nature of having these awkward teen years and the experiences that they had and why those seemed like they were so unique and so special to the people, why they are considered formative as opposed to like we only do a podcast about people being 27 and what happened in your 27th year.
Yeah.
So it did raise the question like, well, what is a teenager? What does it even mean?
Exactly.
What does it even mean, Stephen?
What did it mean, Brandon? I'm still figuring that out about my own teenage experience, as I imagine many people are. We dug around a little bit in order to get a bit clearer of a perspective on kind of those nuts and bolts of being a teenager. I actually reached out to an MFT who I know in the Bay Area who's worked predominantly with teenagers and adolescents throughout his career and also works with couples and some adults and stuff too. So I tracked him down after
marriage
many years and had a...
I was going to say NFT. It almost sounded like you said NFT. Like, oh, and now people are NFTs, which isn't that surprising.
Oh, shucks.
Marriage and family therapist. Awesome.
That was going to eat at me.
We had a little mystery inside our mystery for a second. Right.
There you go. Yes. So anyway, so he was a great guy. He sold me this digital coin.
Run away, Stephen, run away.
And bada bing, bada boom, teenagers.
No,
bye.
It happened again. So he is a marriage and family therapist who's really worked predominantly in the space that involves teenagers, right?
Cool.
And so I was able to pick his brain a little bit, and that was very fun. I should also note that before and actually during the very early years of me starting to do local reporting, I was a high school teacher for 10 years. I worked in 9th to 12th grade for almost the entire time. And I worked with students with mild to moderate disabilities. And that sort of ranged from everything from ADHD to reading disabilities to emotional sort of disturbances and everything in between. So living with autism, the whole gamut of folks who are having a little bit of trouble.
People who need a little extra attention, for whom the kind of traditional method of learning doesn't necessarily may not satisfy in the same way that it should.
Totally. Yeah. So I guess I just wanted to note that because I've never been able to not see things through that lens ever after having worked in that space. So
And thank you. I was about to say thank you for your service, which sounds very like military salute, but I've said it many times, everyone knows my parents were teachers, and I know how hard that is, rewarding but very hard. And so I'm always that's a hero's work right there.
It was fun too. I mean, that's the thing.
Loved teaching. Neither one of them, if you're not meant to be a teacher, or maybe, I think some people are meant to be teachers for certain periods of time in their lives, and then and that's incredibly invaluable. Some people are meant to do it forever, and some people aren't meant to do it at all. And my parents both felt called to it forever. So yeah, I definitely agree with you that it's, you can be passionate and have a great time and also have it be like incredibly taxing. And
it was rough and it was time to go. And then I went. So anyways,
but now you're my teacher. And
hey,
so Brandon,
but also both of your parents, I'm just putting this together, Both of your parents worked with teenagers as like
correct.
Their career.
Just that's exactly
endless
right.
Endless cycle.
I never
of
thought about
teenagers.
It.
Yeah.
I've thought about it in the context of constantly talking about my parents being high school teachers, yeah. But I've never thought about it in the context of me choosing to be interested also in teenagers.
That's right. Yeah. How their weird
really
little
funny.
Brains work.
Yeah.
We had to think about the question of how do you answer such a big question? And that was, you know, what was fun and what was tricky. It's huge, you know. It's like, what is a shoe? I mean, I guess in a way, don't think about that too much. But it was a big question that had a lot of possible answers. And so in order
sure.
to break it down, Stephen and I like to default to a little thing we call science.
Love it.
And technology.
Big fan of science.
Yeah. One of the things that I was really interested in, it was based on something that I had heard some years ago and wanted to see if it was true, which was that the idea of a teenager, the concept of adolescence and all that stuff, is actually a fairly recent invention.
Really? Like,
yeah, we think of, you know, the teenager as this particular kind of developmental stage
yeah.
between straight-up childhood and straight-up adulthood. And it's like, well, this is this period when you're, you know, an idiot.
Uh-huh.
not to boil down your podcast too much. But, you know, when you're doing things that seem so clearly like, well, you can't be treated like a child and you can't be prosecuted as an adult. Yet, but in
thank
fact,
God,
yeah, more or less, depending on the state you're in. So the teenager is a fairly recent invention in the grand scheme of things. And in fact, if you think about what the teenager is, what it represents, what it does, it really all started after, not the first, but the second World War, World War II. All this stuff was swirling around then. Before then, in the Great Depression, you would actually have kids working. You know, young people, teenagers who were treated as an adult, who would be working alongside, you know, older adults in jobs that now there's just no way we would put a kid to do.
Yeah.
So all of that changed after the Second World War for a couple of reasons. One was that mass media came along, right? TV, radio, all of those things. And that recognized that there was a very strong market in this weird cohort of people who were really fascinated by music and art and bright colors. And then connected to that, it was the idea that you can also sell stuff to these people. So not only are they interesting to make stuff for, but of course they have this, all of a sudden, this tremendous economic power that all of these advertisers want to appeal to. So all of a sudden, media comes along and immediately starts talking to this group of people who have enough development to have opinions and things they want, but don't have full-time jobs yet. So that means they get saddled with their parents. And so the kids want something, they appeal to the parents, and then the parents are sort of enthralled to these teens. So that was one thing. This is from a book called Hitmakers. It came out in 2017 by Derek Thompson, who is an editor at The Atlantic. He said there were kind of three things that happened. One was compulsory public education for kids. Between the 20s and 30s, all of these kids in high school went up. So all of a sudden, a lot more people in school, creating their own culture, creating their own social life, and not working alongside parents. Second thing was the economic boom, as I said. After the war, all of a sudden, there's all of this money that's available because people have good jobs, and kids are demanding you spend it on them. Third thing is the car, right? Teenagers were able to go out, kind of like with high school, they could go out and have their own lives. And then that all fed back into this mass media thing of like, well, we can tell stories about kids being in cars. You can think about all the stuff from the 50s and 60s where the car was a symbol of freedom and where teenagers were having adventures and all of that stuff. So you sort of have this growing conception of this being who is more interesting and more dynamic than a little child, but is not quite an adult because there's all these social structures around them, like they live at home and they don't have jobs. And so that was sort of the beginning of this concept. And then all of that stuff was extremely valuable. So you have this kind of self-reinforcing mechanism where they have economic power and they're controlling the media in a way, and they're just sort of building up this weird social structure.
First of all, this is all fascinating, and I feel super embarrassed that I don't really think of like being a teenager as being a particularly new concept, but everything you're saying makes absolute sense. I was having the, like, as I was listening to you, I was sort of having this little tiny backward back of my mind conversation with myself, like, I mean, because I think of like the jazz age as mm-hmm. being this sort of very modern, I mean, we call, you know, Art Deco, we think of still as kind of looking modern. So whenever I think about, like, if you had said that it hadn't existed before the 20s, I would have immediately bought that. But I was almost trying to push back in my mind, like, well, but I know, but like flappers, remember? And then I was like, wait, none of that has anything to do with teenagers. Like, there's nothing about that gives rise to this idea of like a teenage life and a sort of teenage identity. And so that totally makes sense. And so with that being said, like, even just the idea of thinking about like Eastern culture or like Russian culture post World War II, the idea of being like really looking across to America and what it had to offer as a teenager, like, it just makes sense. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like East Germany, like that, like the idea of being a teenager in a country where you're not really considered a teenager yet because mm-hmm. it's not a westernized culture, it's not a capitalist culture, so it's not acknowledging the same age group, but you have enough of an awareness because of mass media, something's trickling in to where a 16-year-old in Moscow might not be having the experience that a 16-year-old in America is. And that's really the time in which we also are taught of this idea of like people behind the Iron Curtain being like, oh, Elvis, like, you know what I mean? Like Cars, teeny bop, like sock hops. And so it's really interesting because I'm realizing that now. I'm like, oh yeah, that is that time frame. Like
yeah.
starting at the end of World War II, like the idea of seeing teenagers from the outside and being fascinated because you're not classified as a teenager yet.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, for sure.
Definitely.
It's really interesting.
And two, when you think about your guests throughout the years that you've had on the podcast, and a lot of the stuff that comes up is echoes of those themes, right? Like a lot of it is talking about stuff that you wanted to buy, stuff that you wanted to listen to,
sure.
stuff that you mm-hmm. wore, ways that you could get away. Like, you know, we sort of just continue to iterate that
yeah.
stuff and have a recognition that like, oh, people were really selling us stuff. They really wanted us to, you know, buy these things. And our response was like, well, I'll buy your Converse, but I'm going to draw on them with uh-huh. a magic marker and show you.
Right, right.
I'm nobody's yeah. fool.
There's also, what you also, I think, point out is that the how arbitrary the idea of, you know, being 18 and that and then you're an adult really is,
no.
right? Or
yes.
or any of yeah. these like sort of like
Absolutely.
the fact that we sort of superimpose this set of ages onto a group of people and say, okay, that's your teenager, those are your teenage years, and as soon as you turn, you know, the clock strikes midnight on that calendar date on your 18th birthday, it's over, welcome to adulthood. And that is actually people don't know exactly when the brain stops to, or it really truly is fully kind of cooked. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of different thoughts on that, but I did come across a piece in the New York Times where April Alexander, a psychology professor at the University of Denver, was asked about that exact question. And she reiterated there's no clear answer, but many folks could now say that our brains don't really fully develop until about age 25. So right there, that's just like, okay, so 18 doesn't really mean anything. And then I kind of started going down the rabbit hole a little bit more about like, well, what the heck is this 18 thing? And I think in addition to all of the reasons that Brandon laid out about how and why teenagers were like defined as such, the age of 18 as the age that you're able to legally vote actually has kind of an interesting history too. Mm. Because up until basically the 70s, many states had the minimum voting age set at 21. And partially, at least, the reason behind that minimum voting age going down to 18 was a result of the Vietnam War, because that really pushed the issue. If you were young enough to be drafted into that war, then you should at least be old enough to vote. So there's a lot of, I think when we think about how we define teenagers as a society, it's really fascinating when you start thinking about all the other things that come into play. Because
sure,
when you're a teenager, you're just told you're a teenager. And so you grow up believing like, oh, well, this is exactly how it has to be. But it's not really backed up biologically. I don't know. It's crazy.
So, like I mentioned at the start of the show, we are going to give you a little peek into me as a teenager from some of the people who knew me best. Here are my friends Sarah, Jen, and Derek. Sarah and I became really, really close in high school and have stayed friends ever since. Jen, I have known since fourth grade, and she is also one of my dearest, dearest friends in the world. And Derek, I've known since first grade, which you'll find out a little bit more about in this upcoming voicemail. And he's amazing.
This is Sarah B.
Hey, Janet. It's Jen.
Janet, happy 500th episode. What an incredible accomplishment. I've been trying to think of some good memories of our time in school together. We've known each other since first grade, so there's a lot to choose from.
Janet and I became good friends junior year of high school, and here are some stream of consciousness memories. Jamocha shakes and potato cakes. Blue Willow for fancy occasions.
Night hiking in Sabino Canyon. Sneaking into various pools and neighborhoods throughout town and swimming really late at night.
Thrift stores, me driving, lights off, fast down Swan, your clean room and my very messy room, you bringing much better music to the table.
Hide and go seek anywhere and everywhere, kind of.
Your dad, our English teacher.
Maybe the most standout teacher was your dad, who I knew as Mr. Varney. The only thing I do remember is that it involved Canterbury Tales, and I was wearing some kind of a cocktail dress. There was a slideshow. I know there was also another one where I had to wear a toga. So there was a lot of, I guess, dramatic play going on in English. But I remember we all had such a wonderful time.
I feel like on a daily basis in English class, we sat right next to each other, and like I would turn around and we would both cross our eyes and start talking to each other. I couldn't see your eyes crossed because my eyes were also crossed and vice versa. And yet we would do that every day and crack ourselves up until the teacher made us stop. I just feel like that epitomizes like how silly you are and how much fun we have and had and have. And I love you.
We did okay plus by each other.
So again, congratulations and be well.
Wonderful. So I'm just checking in to let everyone know that I am still queen of the world in the eyes of many of my friends and family who received wild grain goods from me for New Year's and Christmas this year. The only question is whether or not they're going to expect something like that every week. And I wouldn't blame them if they did, because it's truly, truly wonderful. Wild Grain is the first ever bake from frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, fresh pastas, and artisanal pastries. And I mean, they are so artisanal. In the best possible way. Every item bakes from frozen in 25 minutes or less. Plus, for every new member, Wild Grain donates 6 meals to the Greater Boston Food Bank, so you can eat good and do good all at the same time. I'm still fantasizing about the pain au chocolat, or chocolate croissants, that came in my Wild Grain box, and I did very reluctantly give most of them away, but as a kid who grew up with a French professor slash teacher for a mom who regularly let us indulge in truly French-baked pastries from a tiny little French family bakery in Tucson, Arizona, I can tell you that these are just as good. What can I say? It shares this delicious pain au chocolat DNA with Wild Grain. Plus, for a limited time, you can get $30 off the first box, plus free croissant in every box when you go to wildgrain.com/JVClub to start your subscription. You heard me, free croissant in every box and $30 off your first box when you go to wildgrain.com/JVClub. That's wildgrain.com/JVClub, or you can use promo code JVClub at checkout. Bon appetit.
Hey, let us guess. You love books, but wish you had more time to read.
Or maybe you used to read a lot, but life has gotten in the way, kids, grad school, you name it.
Maybe you don't know where to start and bookish social media is overwhelming. How do people on TikTok read so many books?
Oh my God, I don't know. And maybe you've been reading the same book for 6 months and now it's permanently attached to your bedside table.
Maybe you don't even know what you like to read anymore.
We're Reading Glasses, and don't worry, we got you.
We'll get you back into reading and help you enjoy books again.
Reading Glasses, every week on Maximum Fun.
Just hearing you say what you said about the voting age and stuff, just and coupling that with Brandon, what you were saying about, you know, consumerism and the identifying things that the machine can benefit from, like, just sort of, I mean, it's not surprising at all. She said putting in a copy of Pink Floyd's The Wall and just like getting stoned and gazing off at it like, yeah, man, capitalism. But just this idea of like reverse engineering adolescence or reverse engineering the psychology aspect of it, because that's the least important to the institution or to like the fabrication that's become bigger than its parts. Like the idea of like, well, what's best for the country is that we send a bunch of young people to go off and fight and die. I guess with that in mind, maybe we should let people vote. I'm like, you know, I mean, bear in mind, like they could still get married. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like there's the idea that there would be a state that's like, you could marry at 14. You can't vote until you're 21, but you can go to war at 18. Yeah. It's like, but it still feels like it's like that there are still things in America that would determine how you identify someone or classify someone that have very little to do with the emotional, physical, psychological needs of an individual. You know what I mean?
For sure. Yeah, I mean,
poor teenagers, man. Poor teenagers.
Poor teenagers.
We're just trying to figure it out.
Ugh.
But yeah, the idea that it's politically expedient to say, well, we got to send somebody to war.
Yeah.
Might as well send these kids.
Might as well make these kids adults.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and I guess we might as well let them vote.
Yeah.
Like if we could do that, you know, then I guess we could let them vote. And then, you know, folks, according, this was actually, this other part was according to a Slate article, was like, it was sort of brought up that teenagers at that time are also starting to become more politically active and more conscious about the world around them, so that it also made maybe perhaps more sense to raise that vote or to lower the voting age to 18 too. So again, still external factors that are at play at this thing that a teenager is just, from the moment that person has consciousness, they're kind of told that they are going to enter this period of teenage dumb or whatever it is. And when you're in it, you're like, oh man, you know, I'm just a teenager. You never question
it. Yeah, for sure. Well, and Brandon, you said something just in our lives off camera yesterday, I think it was yesterday, that really stuck with me, which is, I don't know, the way you put it, do you remember how you put it? You were just talking about how when you're a teenager or any age, you can't, it's almost like you can't prove a negative, right? Like you think you're the fullest version of yourself that you'll ever be because you are up to that moment. Like
you're always 100% of yourself, but that's because we were talking about this recognition of talking to younger people and very smart younger people who, you know, and I'm saying like people in their teens and 20s who are very smart and can have a conversation with you. And I just sort of would notice that there would be not gaps in conversation, but just sort of gaps in their knowledge base, where, you know, you can talk to somebody who has lived and just has more experience at their disposal that they can bring up. And so there's sort of a richness to conversation that's not just intellectual, that's not just
that's
about
not
learning.
Just, that's experiential. Right. That's
but
a word,
they
right?
can't feel that. You know, when you
can't feel
15,
the absence of that.
You're
really.
100% of yourself at 15. You're 100% of yourself at 45. But it's hard to recognize at 15 that there's this gulf between you and this other person.
Yeah.
But you can recognize it or sort of sense it in the other direction where you're like, oh, this person, and you know, you can certainly sense it. Like if someone's really immature, you're like, oh, well, that's just because, but even with a very mature person who's very smart, you can still sort of sometimes sense like, oh, there's just things that you don't know yet. You haven't gone through yet.
Yeah.
And it's sort of fascinating to experience that, but it's hard to, yeah, again, it's just you can't sense the void.
That's exactly right. And Stephen, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because to be honest with you, we were talking about, and I don't mean this in like a reductive, like pat someone young on the head way, But we were, I think it came about, or at least in part came about, because somewhere in conversation, someone had brought up the fact that this person was very young and was seeing, for example, their professor. Now, that was something that I facilitated when I was, it was like my second time around in college. So I was in my early 20s. And maybe this is a girl thing, but again, I don't want to be too reductive about that. But Stephen, like when we talk about a 45-year-old person dating a 17-year-old person, the 17-year-old is not going to feel like they're too young. Like they're just like, I don't feel like that's a thing. I mean, maybe some folks would, but if you've already gotten yourself into that situation, you're 100%, like Brandon was saying, you're 100% yourself. You're 100% of your full self. And you're like, I'm bringing it all to the table. I'm very mature. I look at my peers. I feel like maybe I'm even a little more mature than they are. And I feel this deep connection with this person who's 45. Like, you're not going to feel the gulf until they start talking about like old Barney Miller episodes or whatever. And you're like me, like, what the fuck are you talking about? But that's cultural, right? That's sort of intellectual.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's like, that's part of the kind of like not blaming a younger person, quote unquote, for like seducing someone or for, because they're never going to perceive it the way you do as you get older. And I see that now because I'm older. And so now I've become that person who's like, when you're my age, you'll understand that you think you're so smart. But I think part of the reason that I've enjoyed doing the podcast and that I feel almost like in the same way being a teacher, I think keeps you connected to younger people in some kind of way. I kind of feel like it helps me to not become that person or to be very, very aware of whether or not I'm that person, because I still feel so close to my own teenage years from talking so much about other people's teenage years with them.
Yeah.
And I feel close to other people's teenage years that I feel like I'm at less risk of being like, oh, kids, like, you don't understand. I feel like I'm like, no, I feel like I understand exactly how you feel because I can sort of project myself back into that young version of myself. But at the end of the day, I can't do anything about the fact that I've had all this experience since then. And I do feel protective of you. Like, you know what I mean? To a teenager that you're like, I feel like I can kind of see it from all angles. And I hope I never lose that. And I have so much respect for adults who are working with teenagers because I feel like we need those bridges. Like, we need those bridges, you know?
I have so much to say about all that.
You talk now.
No, well, I think that like, so I did spend my entire 20s into my early 30s going to a high school, every day. You know, as a younger teacher,
because you failed out of school,
because I just had to keep going.
You posed as a teacher so that you could finally get your degree.
Finally, they had to escort you off the campus.
It was a sad day. But if you think about it, like from the time I was like 6 years old until the time I was like 32 or 33 years old. Or later, however old I was, I think it was like 33 or 34, I had never left a traditional educational environment. Like I was in kindergarten.
Oh my God, you and my dad would get on like a house on fire for that reason and more.
But it's like, it's crazy because and then I went to college right after that. And then I was like kind of in between stuff, like for like 8 months out of college. And then I started substitute teaching. And then from there, it was just go time. And I do believe that it really provided me with this priceless perspective on what it means to be a teenager and to continue to feel connected to sort of that really important creative sense of wonderment that exists in those teenage years.
Yes.
Because I really felt like I was able to keep something for a little bit longer than some of my other, you know, at one time peers who then went directly into some form of workforce, right? And I feel like it really allowed my brain to stay a lot more elastic and a lot more creative in many different ways. I also believe that, like, in America specifically, one of the biggest areas still where we find, like, deep divisions that are just built into society is around age, because we and if you think about it, like, unless you are a licensed professional, once you become an adult, it is just not acceptable. And in many cases, I want to have this sort of disclaimer, in many cases, for really, really, really important good reasons to protect children, right, for some of the reasons that you sort of touched upon earlier, that kids aren't necessarily going to always know what's wrong or right, and in a person who's had more experiences really will. So a lot of those, the laws that are in place to sort of separate youth from adults are there for good reasons. However, if you think about it, it's like not okay if you're a 26-year-old person to be like out to coffee with a 16-year-old, right? Like in society, that just like does not occur unless they are part of your immediate family or like very close family friends. And I think being a teacher, having also gone through the right degree of training to make sure that and vetting that it's like, yes, we are granting you this responsibility and ability to be interacting with these people who are still in their teens. I think by doing that, you sort of leapfrog over this really, really rigid barrier that still exists in society. And so for that, I feel really lucky to have spent all those years as a teacher.
Oh my God, absolutely. And it's funny, that brings up first of all, I'm going to say, I want to check in with you in 14 years to see how this has affected you being a dad.
Oh yeah.
And then also, Brandon, I don't know if you saw it, maybe you saw it, Stephen, but there was something recently in the New York Times about, there was like a feature on a woman, I'm sure she's like, of course she's Swedish or Danish, but there she's written a couple of books. And I think they featured her recently because there's a sort of, I wish I could remember. Now this is going to be my next episode with you guys because this is the mystery that has to be solved. Although that probably could just be looked up on the internet. But anyway, she wrote it. She's the sort of overreach of the overarching concept is the idea of being like exuberantly old and continuing to say yes to things. And one of the things that comes up in the profile about her in the interview with her is that she, as you know, an 87-year-old or whatever, again, do not remember what her name is, spends a lot of time with young people, and not in a structured like I am a teacher kind of way, but in just a way of like, how do I stay around young people? And that same kind of idea was brought up, was like, it's just not, we just separate by age so often. And I will add to that, and that the, like, everyone benefits from spending time around, like, it's a different situation being with a rad non-relative woman your grandma's age who is just going to, I mean, and by the way, you can have a rad grandma, I'm not saying that at all, but like when I think about my own grandmother, I don't know that was like, and I would hang out with her if she weren't my grandma. Like, I want to believe I would because I love my grandma with all my heart, but I'll never know. You know what I mean? I'll never know if 16-year-old me would have wanted to spend as much time with her. But if it was an outside woman, and I don't know, I just feel like she benefits, I benefit, we all benefit from understanding that about each other. And that is one of the things I love about show business.
Totally.
Because you are surrounded by people of all ages, and there's a lot of like peer stuff that happens that erases those lines, to your point, sometimes in ways maybe it shouldn't, but also in really great ways where I can hang out with a 15-year-old and be like, you're awesome. And they're like, you're awesome. And then we both go over to Crafty, and the woman who runs Crafty is 70, and we're like, you're awesome.
Yeah.
Like, that's a really, one of my favorite things about being in this business, like, for reals.
Well, what both of y'all are talking about that I think is funny is that you're finding these ways to get around the artificial separation that we have now put upon us. Like, little kids go here, teenagers go here, and then adults go here. And
unless you're me, and then I'm at the kids' table every Thanksgiving, because that's where I want to be.
Yeah, and then when you're older, you're shunted off somewhere else, whereas for most of human history, we all were in the same place. You would watch somebody, because you lived in the same community, you would watch someone from birth to death, and so you would have interactions with all ages at all time, and that was
because that enables you to be all ages at all times.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you can kind of be, you can be a teenager when you're 50, when you're 70, when you're 90.
And it erases some of those distinctions.
And it erases some of the like ageism and disrespect of our elders too, because you're not just like, you know, assuming that they're losing functionality won't understand you or will think that, you know, we'll be too conservative or whatever.
It cuts in every possible way that, you know, that we miss out on a great deal of generational wisdom in either direction by, you know, sort of approaching how we set up like capital C communities at large like this.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I do have one of the most important people in my entire life is a woman named Claudette Sutherland, who is in her 80s, who I've known since she lived below us in the apartment complex in New York when in the 80s. And she was my parents' best friend, and she's the only person who I've known. She's the third person I've known third longest since my mom and dad. And she's creative and wonderful and fascinating, and has been such an important creative sort of inspiration for me my entire life. She was in the original Broadway performance of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. She's like had this wonderful, unbelievable life. And I've learned so much from her from the time I was a kid, and now that we remain friends and now peers as adults with, you know, 40 plus years between us. I think about that relationship all the time. I thought about it for sure with what you were just saying now, Janet. And you're right, Brandon, that we are really shuttled into all these different boxes in this very artificial way. And I think that it causes a lot of problems. And to get back to the idea of how it could cause problems for teenagers, you know, this whole idea that, again, when you're 18, you're ready to start making these like big time life decisions, that's not based on any science. Because what folks will point out if you talk to people who work with teenagers is that their brains just aren't developed in such a way where they are truly able to make long term decisions about the future. Right? They're still in this space where it's like shiny object. I'm going to do, you know, what's immediately sounds good. You know, that's another
problem. Raccoon years.
the raccoon years. And, you know, way back to how I think about, you know, maybe a younger student in college, you know, dating a professor. I think the issue that I feel like gets a little dicey there is when you get into the idea of brain development. And you can't really fault that student because, again, you are exactly who you are. You don't know what you don't know. However, in many cases, you know, is someone a great deal older could know that. And then at what point is like the power dynamic there leveraged in sort of a way that's unfair to the younger person because of just like what they got going on in between their ears, right? And this was something that I was asked the marriage and family therapist with whom I spoke about being a teenager and adolescence, etc. Again, his name's Dennis Barron. He works in the Bay Area. So I asked, well, what is it specifically about their more predisposed to make some bad decisions based on like not really thinking things through? And to that, he said this.
Two things come to mind. One is just brain development. The part of the brain behind your forehead, the frontal cortex, is not fully online yet. That's the part of the brain that says, like, maybe I shouldn't jump off that cliff.
Mm-hmm.
No, into the water, because like I could get hurt. Or, you know, maybe 95 is a little fast because it's raining. Mm-hmm. You know, that part of the brain when we're adults and we're like, yo, I got to get to that appointment. If I go 95, I can get there on time. But it's been raining lately. You know what? I'll just be late because I know that if I'm 10 minutes late, they'll probably still take me. That whole thought process is not there when you're a teen. So it's like the gas pedal's there. The brakes are just not fully developed.
I think that's a great analogy for that. The gas pedal's there, but the brakes aren't.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because once you've lived through being a teenager, if you are able to connect yourself back to that place, it's also sometimes hard not to insert your own development and your own maturity into that. You just sort of try to stuff it back into your memories and go like, well, I never would have made that stupid of a decision. Like, you know what I mean? Because you can't separate your consciousness that you've collected through time. And I feel like the reason I'm saying this is because, as Brandon knows, and as everyone who listens to the podcast regularly knows, I do have an interest in like criminal justice reform and true crime and wrongful convictions and all of that. And that is definitely very connected to the idea of like young people being tried as adults and what kind of accountability we place on people who are, you know, in their early 20s and below. Like, I think that we as a culture love to
like try to infuse our memories of ourselves as teenagers with the consciousness we have as adults and are like, well, I never would have done that. I would never have made that decision. I would never have killed someone when I was 15 years old. This person's a psychopath. They need to be in prison for the rest of their lives. They're never going to be a safe, you know, person to have in society and all that. And so these conversations are so important for that reason as well, is that they can have like huge implications on whether like we have to, as a culture, as a democracy, whatever we are these days, we have to really listen to our experts and bear those things in mind before we just throw people away. Because I don't care if you think now you wouldn't have made that decision. Like, you don't know this person's circumstance, and you certainly don't know their psychopathy or lack thereof. And the idea that, you know, you're judging them as the adult you are, you know, and by the way, they're not going to get judged by 15-year-olds in a jury. So, like, all of that is sort of messy. Speaking of messy,
but you know, the idea of a show called Teen Jury is awesome.
Oh wow, yeah,
that's a great idea. Teen,
and they get to try the adults.
What about jury high school? You're in high school, but you're learning how to be a good juror, because we also don't teach our jurors enough before they have to make huge decisions about people's lives.
Yeah.
So it's a high school full of kids who are just learning how to be juries.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Next
hijinks ensue.
The next door is teens learning to be lawyers.
Uh-huh. Yep. Teen lawyers. Yeah.
Teen lawyers.
This is gonna be great.
Yeah.
This is just as good as vampires and werewolves as teens. Don't worry.
It basically is. Yeah. Well, and that's the other tricky thing about, you know, the teenage years and the early 20s is you can't necessarily sense those differences. Again, like I was saying earlier, you know, I only just realized in having a conversation with someone recently who's very smart, I was like, oh, there's something that is missing in the conversation, which is like just your life experience. But it's hard to spot that stuff in a way that it's really easy to see, you know, why is a 9-year-old not an adult? Like, you can just sort of, that stuff is so evident. But what you can't tell is the nuances of brain development. Like, Stephen, like your friend Dennis said, you know, the frontal lobes are not fully connected. There's still a lot of, you know, sort of looseness in the part of the brain that controls decision making.
But it's really hard for people to conceive of that the same way you can, like, you don't have as much hair under your armpits, or you haven't grown, you're not tall yet, or whatever. Right. It's a lot harder. Yeah, you're so right, Brandon. Like, it's just really hard to conceive of that in the same kind of way.
And the idea that the part of your brain that controls pleasure is fairly overdeveloped at that point. This comes from the book by Derek Thompson I mentioned earlier, but he points out you have this unfortunate collision of an underdeveloped decision-making and an overdeveloped pleasure-seeking, so that stuff that an adult would say, I'm not going to do that, somebody younger is like, yes, let's do that. And consequently, you have teens who are more inclined toward risk-taking behavior and higher mortality rate. Says Americans between 15 and 19 have a mortality rate that's about 3 times higher than those 5 to 14. So there's just this period where you spike, and those things.
I remember that. I remember making a lot of really bad decisions and just feeling not feeling like nihilistic, not feeling like knowingly reckless, but just sort of, I can sort of look back and feel like there's just an absence where fear should be. And by the way, I was a fairly fearful teen, so I can't explain that at all. Like, I, you know, yet, you know, it's like, oh, I was afraid of XYZ, but like, I had zero issue like hopping on a motorcycle with someone I wasn't sure was a good driver, and just without a helmet being like, let's go 80. I can't explain that now.
Yeah, you weren't afraid of the stuff you were supposed to be afraid of.
That's exactly right. And
you know, I think this, I'd constantly run into this teaching high school too, where you would have some sort of more traditional or old school teachers, you know, ask me about some student who was on my caseload and say, well, why wouldn't they just insert, and then XYZ insert something very rational and like conservative that somebody in their early 40s might do? And it's like, well, because they're not, that's not where that person's at. So it's really this, it's so futile to try to superimpose your own like worldview onto somebody who just is not there developmentally yet. However, that happens a lot because young kids can get themselves into super adult situations, and they can get them, but they don't have that the equipment to sort of get them out of it.
Great point.
And I think about it, and then it makes you think about how ridiculous it is that we place more pressure on teenagers than almost any other group of people. Maybe the only other group of people are like in the business world in some like cutthroat industry, and you like have to succeed, or society and your peers and your professional peers are going to think you're a failure. Like maybe there's something in that world that has like a matched sense of, or that has like an equal amount of pressure. But like universally, I don't think we as a society pressure one group more than teenagers, which is crazy.
Okay, one more hop into the Wayback Machine for you to learn about teenage JV. Here is my dear, dear, dear friend Such, my dad, and my amazing friend Torin.
Hi, Janet.
Hey, Janet, it's Torin.
Hi, Miss J. For your listeners on your podcast, that's the name I gave you as sort of a term of endearment when you were a little girl.
Congratulations on 500 episodes of the JV Club.
The best thing that I had in my teaching career was the last full year that I was teaching, and you and so many of your friends who had been guests in our house were all in my senior advanced placement English class at Rincon High School in Tucson, Arizona. And it was just a terrific year and a great way to go out for me as a teacher after 26 years.
I've compiled a kind of stream of consciousness list of impressions that have stayed with me over the many years.
So I did find your entry, what you wrote in my yearbook. Here we go. Clichés, number one. A lot has happened this year.
Searching for the perfect journal and discussing what makes the perfect journal. Lined or unlined, big or small, hardback or bendy.
Number two, we've been through a lot together. Number three, there have been ups and downs, mostly ups.
Steve Martin and our undying love for LA Story. Grease sing along at my house. Skinny dipping during a summer meteor shower.
Number four, we'll be seniors next year. Number five, our friendship has been special for the past number sign years.
Trading in CDs at Bookman's and going through every single CD in the racks so we didn't miss any hidden treasures, just like we did with the racks of clothing and jewelry at our favorite thrift stores.
And last cliche I have is the truest and simple mannest thing I can say, and then in quotes, I just want to hold you, I don't want to hold you down. I love you as always, Janet.
Every feeling we felt was so honest and intense and raw. High school was incredibly painful and confusing and isolating at times, but the laughter and joy were also honest and intense and raw. Just remembering laughing with you all makes the muscles in my face feel warm and alive and wonderfully sore.
So thanks for that Graham Nash shout out and for your thoughts. Congratulations on 500 episodes.
That is the epitome of high school to me. Congratulations again, my friend. Really, really proud of you.
Congratulations on your 500th podcast. I'm so proud of you. I love you so very much.
Wonderfuls, I'm back to talk more Blonde Medicine. This week, I'm excited to talk about the debut album from Valerie Tosi called Beach Trash. Valerie Tosi's Beach Trash is available to stream everywhere, and you can get it on super cool, transparent magenta, one of my favorite all-time colors, vinyl. Blonde Medicine has put out all sorts of great albums from folks like Kanis Mobley, Subha Agarwal, Anika Dell, Amy Miller, Irene Too. And I gotta go ahead and give an extra shout out to Valerie, who, in addition to being a fantastic stand-up comedian, was also on an episode of Stand Against Evil and kicked ass. So I know her as a fantastic and funny actress. Check out blondemedicine.com/maxfun to browse a selection of stand-up LPs and use code JVCLUB at checkout to get 20% off your entire order. I have just named a litany of brilliant comics. You gotta go to blondemedicine.com/maxfun and give this great company and those wonderful stand-ups some love. Remember to use the code JVCLUB at checkout to get 20% off your entire order.
Which animal has the most bones?
Why isn't Pluto a planet?
Why are bees electrically charged?
Let's find out together on our show, Let's Learn Everything, where we learn anything and everything interesting.
My name's Caroline, and I studied biodiversity and conservation.
My name's Tom, and I studied computer science and cognitive blah, 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 blah.
Did you?
And my name's Ella, and I studied stem cells and regenerative medicine.
On our show, we do as much research as you would for a class, but we don't get in trouble for making each other laugh.
Subscribe to Let's Learn Everything every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Just in terms of like making those kinds of decisions or you know, being in a place where you put yourself in an adult situation and you don't know how to handle it like an adult, so to speak. And I, again, do not mean that in a disrespectful or talking down way to teenagers. I love yous. But in talking, you know, in all the episodes that I've done, like there are definitely, you know, people who absolutely had the same experience I did, which was very much getting into trouble, very much making sort of existentially strange decisions and, you know, not necessarily knowing I was doing it at the time. And then I have people who kind of made those decisions later, like when their brains were still cooking and they were 21, they were doing all of the crazy things that in my mind, I'm like, well, I think I had matured past that when I was 13 because I was really stupid when I was 13. And like all of those things that are so arbitrary. But creative people, you know, there, it's hard to, one thing that I hear a lot is like, I wouldn't take it back, you know, even though I could have died, I wouldn't take it back. Or even though I got bad grades, I wouldn't take it back. I wouldn't change stuff. And I'm just interested because, you know, a lot of the time we give this credit to artists of like, well, they're living their life experience and then they're pouring that experience back into their work. Like, is there a relationship between regret and lack of regret because of what you choose to do for a living as an adult? Like, does that make any sense? That's not even a question. It's just sort of me meandering. But
yeah. Yeah. I had thought about that when I was thinking about, I mean, when we were researching for this episode and all of your guests in the past and, you know, obviously a diversity of experiences and kinds of people and interests and stuff. But, you know, a lot of them, because they're artists, would fall under the kind of category of gifted, right? You know, this idea, I think, of it now is such a minefield. But like, you know, some kids were pulled out. They're like, you're gifted, whatever that means, and you got to go in these classes. And other kids are normal in there in this one, and other kids have to be held back. And all, just how dicey that is.
Oh, yeah.
But there's obviously a lot of research on what it means to be gifted or, you know, the newer term, neurodivergent, which is associated with autism, but can also just mean sort of gifted in a way of like you're thinking about things differently. And there's research along those lines about how these are people for whom a sense of self and, you know, having this open-mindedness is a quality that comes up a lot. And that sort of makes you more inclined to question things. It makes you more inclined to push back against the status quo. And that obviously when you're a young person who doesn't have, for example, the ability to vote or go live on your own, can cause a lot of problems. And so you see, this is from an article in Psychology Today by a psychiatrist named Grant Hillary Brenner. He writes about how, quote, gifted individuals experience bias, at times stigmatized for their gifts. They're more likely to be bullied, increasing risk of emotional and relationship problems, which may reach clinical significance. And then he goes on to talk about how early life identity problems can show up and mental illness, all this stuff. I mean, it's no surprise to anyone that you know, being gifted, being creative is associated with a risk of mental illness. But it's also a question of, just from an evolutionary standpoint, if it causes all these problems socially, if it causes all these problems kind of psychologically, how does that stuff continue to show up in the gene pool? Why haven't we weeded it out? Well, being gifted obviously confers advantages, right? Like discovery and creation and all those things show up. But it sort of means that we're always going to be saddled with these kind of two sides of things.
Well, for sure. But also, like, I feel like, again, I do not have the data. I do not have the data to back this up. I'm speaking only from memory, which is very flawed, as we all know.
Off the cuff.
But I do feel like my guests, like, I feel like there's probably an equal number of people who were diagnosed with something like ADD or ADHD as were diagnosed, quote unquote, as being gifted. And, you know, the and why is, like, what if you're both, or what if you're neither, mm-hmm. or what if you are, or what if you become what they say you are because your brain's still cooking, and so someone tells you you have ADHD and you feel like that's a judgment, or you feel like that's like, well, you're just not, you can't learn the way we learn,
right.
or, you know, you're gifted, so you're learning better than anyone else can learn. Like, how do we, I mean, Stephen, like, what do you think about that? Like, how do you approach that? I mean, are we damaging our kids by putting those labels on them, or?
But I think there are so many, it's such a nuanced topic, right? Because in my time as a special education instructor, who was also spent time working with school psychologists to make special education eligibility determinations, I think that kids get overdiagnosed with ADHD. Mm. I don't think
ADD.
That's possible, and that is out there, and it's real. I think for some students, I think for some people who are very much accurately diagnosed, I'm not of the camp that this is like, you know, some like made up. I fully believe it's very, very real. And then even for some of those folks, medication in some cases can be like a total game changer and can literally like change lives. I also think that that's overprescribed. Anywho, think that in terms of, I totally agree with you that, you know, being gifted and having something like ADD or ADHD, those two things are certainly not mutually exclusive. And if anything, sometimes they just naturally go along with one another. And when I was talking with Dennis about ADD and ADHD in adolescents, especially in the ones that in his experience of working with adolescents, he brought up a really interesting perspective on this exact subject. And I would really like to share that with you folks now.
Why is it like a collection of traits wasn't weeded out by the gene pool? ADHD or ADD is only a thing now because it doesn't fit into the models that we have available, like the modern school, like mm-hmm. modern office culture doesn't match so well with it. But if you think about like hunter-gatherers, and you're 40 and you're like, I don't have much longer. I'm checking out soon. Old age is hitting me, you know, and you got a kid who's 14 and eager to run up that mountain and doesn't want to sit and weave baskets all day and wants to like go explore the other side of the river.
And
that's a real strength. That's something that you'd be like, yeah, man, go look up that mountain. I'm going to chill right here. I'm almost 40. You know, things are getting tough. Probably a real advantage during much of humanity.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's so cool. I mean, I think it's like so empowering too to other kids who are living with ADD or ADHD too, right? Like, I think that it connects to all this other stuff we're talking about teenagers, about how everything is just sort of superimposed on this group that already is facing more pressure than, you know, kind of any other group out there.
Yeah, I really feel, I mean, unsurprisingly, I already felt so much empathy, and now I feel like even more. So this is really cool. No, it's really cool. It's really been wonderful to put a little bit more of a philosophical overview on it, because I am so in the weeds in such a way that I absolutely love when I'm talking to people, and it's so personal and it's so about one unique experience, and I'm just in and loving the juiciness of like the things that are feeling familiar to me because of past conversations I have, or the feelings that, you know, I like when we play MASH and there's like a string of similar answers that I can't necessarily explain why, or there's a weird answer, a weird and wonderful, and I'm just using weird in a like general unusual kind of way with no judgment attached, but an answer that I've never heard. And then, you know, in the course of three more years, like other people, it crops up with other people. The best example, as everyone knows, because I love to bring it up all the time on the podcast, is when people say that they were one of their first crushes who makes it into the MASH game. It was Robin Hood, was the Fox cartoon Robin Hood. and everyone sort of says it, not unlike the late bloomer thing, like everyone sort of, a lot of people say it like, this is going to sound so weird, or this is going to sound like disturbing, or like, don't judge me, but, and then it's the best feeling in the world when I can be like, you're not even the first person to say it, dude, you're good. Like, you're golden. Yeah. You're part of something, you know? So I love, but thinking about it from a 30,000 foot view rather than just being right down there, you know, face to face is like, it's very, I'm just loving this. So thank you so much.
I did look that up.
You did? Oh my God.
I did.
That's,
I mean,
amazing.
We had talked about that before, and I was like, is there something to the phenomenon of people being attracted to the Robin Hood fox from?
Yeah.
Turns out it does show up. BuzzFeed did a thing about the sexiest Disney characters.
Okay.
A lot of people like that. There was a tweet from last year, a person who is Gen X and had said that she was attracted to Robin Hood, and then a millennial friend said, what? And then Gen Z, 11-year-old, said, but that's illegal. And so her point was like, only Gen X people are attracted to Robin Hood. Maybe that's the generational thing.
I disagree.
And I think that you're right, because Disney based the Robin Hood character on this medieval character called Reynard the Fox, who was this trickster who got into all kind of trouble. All of these old stories about him basically being a con artist. He was like the first kind of weird anti-hero, and he was just going around screwing over all of the other animals. I think he stole a badger's penis. I can't remember all the stories. But there was a lot of... He was up to some shit. Reynard was up to some shit.
Uh-huh.
And Disney was like, we love this guy. But he was a really popular character then. Now, I dare you to tell me that in the medieval Dutch days that somebody wasn't feeling a little bit horny for Reynard the Fox. I think that's been with us as long as the desire to run up the mountain.
Absolutely. I love that. And again, like, you can take it all the way to furries, and you can, and everything in between, like, again, spectrum, and, you know, whatever that's bringing up for people. Look, I don't know. You know, Disney has had a massive effect on many people, and, you know, I'm sure, and then anime has, and like all that stuff gets all swirled together, and no judgment from me. No judgment. I'm always excited. Like, I really started, because someone said that a long time ago, like, I feel like I started expanding out what I characterized crushes as being. So now I make sure to include like cartoons and video game characters and animal, like, I don't care, you know, I want people to feel like liberated and able to say, you know, I had a crush on Robin Hood or any other version of
that's
that.
That's awesome.
That's so cool. It's so great that you looked that up. I love it. Reynard the Fox. Got it.
That reminds me, too, of something that the psychologist I mentioned earlier, Brenner, had said. He was talking about gifted people, but I mean, I think what we're talking about today, just as far as how do you reconcile what's biologically true, what's evolutionarily true about humans with the things that are social constructs. And again, he was talking about gifted people, but I think it's true for, you know, teenagers of any stripe, right? Like, because they tend to be these little sponges and their brains are still cooking. And he said this thing that I thought was really smart, which is, quote, colluding with bullying, neglect, exclusion, and other forms of adversity encountered by gifted people who often have the best intentions towards others is likely to produce more evil geniuses. We have enough already.
Hmm.
So I think, you know, there's something to be said about, like, maybe we need to revise our sense of what's the best way to treat people and what kind of categories, you know, we're thinking about now that are, especially in the light of the pandemic, that are so, you know, that have just made us rethink, like, how a society is supposed to run. And if we just revert to all the old things, then we're going to have a lot of the same problems.
I mean, the pandemic, Brandon, you actually just reminded me of another study that I almost forgot to mention. Some news out of Stanford University about a study published on December 1, 2022 in Biological Psychiatry, Global Open Science. And not to get too far into the weeds of this, they found that the brains of a certain group of adolescents actually physically aged more during the pandemic, right? And they only this is not something that has never occurred before, but typically it's under times of like abuse or stress or trauma. So we don't know about what ramifications the pandemic will have on this cohort of teens who are hardest hit by it. in 10 to 15 years? Like, are those folks going to be, like, what is their brain development going to look like? And how, what are they going to be like in the workforce in their mid-30s? Like, we don't know any of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping for the best. Maybe something really special will be born out of it, you know, that, like, we could never have seen coming because we were all worried that it was going to be a negative thing, and then it turned out to be like this really kind of positive.
I share a certain sense of like hopeless optimism as well. I do believe that.
I really flip flop on that all the time. It's like I'm very inconsistent about that.
But like Dennis said, there's always going to be somebody who wants to run up the mountain.
True.
That's right. That's what, and we need it. We need it, guys. This has been so fun and so wonderful and such a great way to mark this 500th episode. I am so happy that this worked out. I'm so happy that Mark and Hal had you on and that this whole thing kind of that you're doing started when it did, because, you know, it would have been just fine and wonderful and great to have, you know, just a great guest, and it could have been, you know, the most famous person of the world, or it could have been someone no one's ever heard of because it's just my neighbor. Like, all of that would have been fine and great and good. But I love this to kind of like mark time in a different way, because I've never done anything like this on the podcast before. So I'm really grateful for both of you to, you know, for having made this so special and having made it a larger conversation and about something bigger.
Well, thank you for having us on. We hope that your listeners now go back and listen to every episode again.
Uh-huh.
With the light of this context, new context on what a teenager is.
That's right.
Spin it up.
That's right. And at some point soon, an AI will be able to just amass all the factoids and put them into a beautiful little package and a series of graphs. And then the three of us can get back together and
really look at
stats and say, okay, we have the data. We have the data.
We have the microfiche.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But until then, everybody, thanks for celebrating my 500th with us. And I'll talk to you next time on the podcast.
I have to remember when you were probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 years old, you came to me and said an outrageously stagey name and said, what do you think of that? And I said, well, I don't know. What would that be for? And you said, maybe that's going to be my name when I'm on television or in movies. And I said, well, that's an interesting name, but I have a suggestion for a name you might really like. Do you want to hear it? And you said, sure, Daddy. And I said, how about Janet Varney? And you said, oh, Dad, that's not a name that would ever be known in Hollywood or in television or movies. Well, on the eve of your 500th podcast, which is an astonishing number, I want you to know that the name Janet Varney is in Hollywood and on television and in the movies. And I'm really proud that you have reached that wonderful number, 500 podcasts. Super.
The show is recorded by me and edited by Julian Burrell. And as always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi. Time machines to go and get us back.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.